Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for conservatives, as always. And, Jim, we start with the good, and it's as a result of bad news from the city of Detroit. We saw the state of Michigan announcing last week that Detroit is filing for bankruptcy. Governor Rick Snyder put it very bluntly. Detroit's broke. He appeared on Face the Nation. Kevin Orr, the emergency manager for Detroit, was a guest on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. And Chris Wallace played the clip of Joe Biden chairing some meeting and reporters asking him about what the federal government could do for Detroit. And Joe Biden's answer, of course, is, I don't know. And Chris Wallace responds with this question, and I think a good answer from Kevin Orr.
What would you like to see the state of Michigan do to help Detroit? What would you like to see Washington do?
Well, right now, I'm an appointed official, not elected official, so I'm not going to stay in my lane. I'm not going to stray into the political morass. But one thing I would say is we've operated on the assumption that we have to cure this process, this problem, on our own. We are not expecting the cavalry to come charging in. We're out here in an outpost, and we have to fix it because we dug this hole. And that's the assumption that we're operating
Who's
on and
we?
How we're going
The city
forward.
Of Detroit? The state
city
of Michigan?
The city of Detroit. The city of Detroit. I mean, a lot of this debt, a lot of the practices that I put forward in my June 14th report, that talked about deferrals, unfunded obligations, borrowings, addiction to debt, even a level of corruption from 2002 to 2008, which was significant, have created this problem.
Jim, it's good to hear that personal responsibility and even community responsibility comes into play here. We know there's a local judge in Michigan who decided that this was dishonoring to the president, so she threw the bankruptcy filing out of court, but something tells me it's probably going to go forward at some point here. But finally, after 50 years of passing the buck, somebody who's got some authority in Detroit understands where the problem came from.
Yeah, the judge's ruling is kind of nutty. I guess it's the only word to come up with it, because, one, if you rule that the state and the city manager don't have the authority to declare bankruptcy, the question would be then who does? And if they don't, then the question is then what happened? A judge can throw, you know, rule reactions to this fiscal crisis any way she likes. That doesn't mean the fiscal crisis isn't there. The fiscal crisis is very simple. Way too much money going out and way too much money owed in the near and far future to bondholders, to the retirement systems, to the pensions, to the benefits paid out to workers, et cetera, and not nearly enough money coming in. And basically not enough people living within the confines of Detroit to tax them to pay for everything they have. The numbers simply cannot be made. You could tax everything at 100% rate and you would not be able to take care of the debt obligations that the city has. So the question is, what do you do in response to that? One of the things that I am struck by, as you hear this occasional murmurs about a bailout of Detroit, even if, you know, we were flush with money right now, you didn't have a $16 trillion debt, and Washington had a big pile of money sitting around, they said, you know what? Detroit's always been a great city. We've always loved the way the Lions and the Tigers and most of these teams have provided easy wins for the rest of our favorite teams. Let's help them out. And so we all loved Axel Foley when he went to Beverly Hills Cop. So, you know, let's help them out. And let's say you gave them the $18 billion or something like that, that is what is required to get them out of this particular hole. Why do we think we would not see a similar circumstance some years down the road? The solution of a bailout is a problem of an enormous lack of money and a system that is built to lose money, a system that has no ability to generate its own wealth, its own wage growth and genuine prosperity from which to create tax income to pay for all the stuff the city wants to pay for. If you don't change that, then a bailout is just going to put you in the same spot some years down the road. And I'm kind of struck by the number of people who don't seem to realize that Detroit needs to fundamentally alter the way that it approaches governance. And sometimes you might go as far as James Pethakakis writes on National Review Online, basically arguing he wants to turn it into an American version of Hong Kong. He wants extremely low tax rates, both property and sales and income and all that other stuff. He wants as minimal regulations as possible and basically try to create a giant enterprise zone, try to make it the best place to do business in the entire country and see what happens. This sounds kind of familiar to me, Greg. I believe it was back in the late 80s that Omni Consumer Products wanted to create Delta City from the cinematic masterpiece RoboCop. So some people may see a sinister tone to this, but it may take something as radical as this to create a situation in which prosperity returns to Detroit. I think we're beyond tweaking. You know, Detroit needs some sort of fundamental overhaul of the way its entire philosophy of governance, what it has been doing decade after decade after decade after decade, has failed colossally. So It's good to see that the governor is arguing against a bailout. I think it's good to see that there really is no strong appetite for it in Washington or in anywhere else in the rest of the country. One of the interesting things I heard on Morning Joe today is that, look, there are a bunch of other cities that are not that much better in circumstances than Detroit is. So if you bail out this one, lots of other cities are going to be, you know, Stockton, California is going to say, what about us? You know, you're going to have a whole bunch of cities that made unsustainable promises in terms of pensions and expenditures and things like that. And the question will be how you handle them. And you'll just see more and more of these problems across the country, I suspect.
I think that's probably true. And it's, of course, Detroit is an extreme example of horrific management and spending and priorities over many, many years. But the economy recently has put a lot of people in difficult straits. And Jim, you'll be pleased to know that the president is pivoting towards jobs. I know this is a new concept that we haven't heard about before, but Dan Pfeiffer, one of the president's top advisors, sent out a note saying that the president is going to, and I would say stop me if you've heard this before, but then you would stop me, because he says in the coming weeks, the president will be laying out steps that Congress can take, steps he'll take on his own, and steps the private sector can take that benefit us all. And he says, instead of talking about how to help the middle class, too many in Congress are trying to score political points, refight old battles, and trump up phony scandals, all to say the president is going to be blaming Republicans for the fact that things aren't better economically. So I guess the more things change, the more they stay the same.
My most recent post on Campaign Spot, which is, look, we all kind of scoff every time the president says, oh, he's pivoting back to jobs and stuff. And as you and I have discussed on this podcast many times, the economy is it's in better shape than it was in, say, you know, end of 2008, most of 2009. But it's not that much better. The unemployment rate is 7.6%. And what's more is that's in the context of a much smaller labor force participation rate, meaning there are a whole bunch of folks who dropped out of the workforce in recent years. Wage growth has been stagnant and actually lost some ground, not just from the recession, but from 2009, Greg, which kind of suggests that, you know, not too many folks have been getting raises. The stock market's doing pretty well. Housing market has sort of recovered in most of the country. But basically, if you've lost your job or you went through economic hard times starting in late 2008, for a whole bunch of folks, it really hasn't ended. Robert Samuelson has a good column in the Washington Post today where he says, besides the obvious economic impact of the Great Recession, there's also a big psychological impact of the Great Recession, which is that even if you didn't lose your job, even if you didn't end up losing your house or going into deep debt or depleting all your retirement savings or something, you have this sense of anxiety that you feel like the economy is much more fragile than it used to be, and you are one sudden turn of the economy away from losing your job, perhaps losing your health insurance, perhaps being underwater on your mortgage and not being able to move. There's a great deal of economic anxiety out there. And as I lay out in the post today, some of these things are driven by policy. I think you can argue that Obamacare is making part-time employment much more attractive to employers than full-time employment. The payroll tax hike back in January probably did a number on our take-home pay and, you know, discretionary spending and things like that. But a lot of it is a workforce that is right now not trained to do anything for the types of the economy that are booming, i.e. fracking and the energy and stuff like that. And it's not easy to get people from a state of not being employable and not having useful skills to a point where they do have useful skills, particularly in a economy that has become more and more reliant on high skills and high tech and things like that. So we have real economic problems, and it appears that the, you know, response of the president is, look, I can't really do anything about it, so I'm going to do my best to make sure the public blames Republicans for it. He's played that card. Obviously, it worked enough for him in the reelection campaign. But we're entering kind of, you know, year five of an economic malaise, and you kind of wonder at some point, don't we need something better than what we've been getting from Washington? We have an economic bad situation and no real prospects for real solutions coming out of Washington anytime in the near future.
Well, certainly some pretty bleak martinis to start off with, even with the good news. We're talking about the bankruptcy of one of the largest cities in America. And now, of course, we've got an economy that refuses to recover. And we've just explained why once again. So we have something with a little lighter flair to close out with a third martini. And the crazy martini, and Jim and I will disagree a little bit on this. And Jim, that's the frenzied interest, not only of the media, but of way too many people in my estimation, for this arrival of the next generation of the royal family, who will be the, I guess, third in line to the throne following Queen Elizabeth II. I've always been baffled by the people who will get up at 3 a.m. for a royal wedding or Princess Diana's funeral and not tape it, just get up well before dawn to watch these sorts of things. And now the fascination with someone who is part of a royal line that we rebelled against 230-some years ago. So there's that aspect of it. And just it's kind of just keeps going with this pop culture obsession that we have. I think the royal family is certainly far less harmless than being obsessed with the Kardashians and that ilk, or sometimes some of the politics we're forced to follow with folks who are running for office in New York City, for example. But it's just too much. And some of these networks sent correspondents over there a week or two in advance just to build up the hype. Just let the kid be born, send out a picture, and let us go on with our lives.
Well, look, Greg, first of all, what do you have against babies?
Nothing. I have a wonderful one.
Of course. I am one of those guys who actually feels that, look, of all the media obsessions, this is a pretty darn harmless one. And what's more, like, look, it's happy news. We're happy for the couple. As of this taping, little baby Joffrey has not yet come out. By the way, Joffrey is the name of the despotic king in Game of Thrones. So they're probably not going to go with that name or Ichabod or any of the other names floating around out there. We don't even know if it's a boy or a girl, so that's some of the excitement and suspense. Look, in a world full of Elliot Spitzers and Anthony Wieners and Geraldo sending out kind of creepy pictures of himself, and, you know, in a world full of really creepy, horrible people, they seem like a good young couple, and they're doing their best to make it in a messy world with only the entire wealth of the royal family to get by on. Uncle Harry is served out in Afghanistan and seems like a good guy when he's not cavorting naked in Las Vegas and stuff. He's willing to, you know, serve his country. They seem like good young folks, and you kind of want them to have a happy ending and all that stuff. I cheer for these folks. I'm excited. I'm going to close with a bit of wisdom from really, I think, one of the definitive philosophers on the royal family, and that is Police Squad Lieutenant Frank Drebin, who said when guarding the queen back in the early late 80s, no matter how silly the idea of having a queen might be to us, as Americans, we must be gracious and considerate hosts. In light of this, having the hype over the Labour Party, you could call it, over in the UK, you know, we should be gracious and considerate and congratulate the kids and celebrate. Look, here's a bit of news that isn't so grim and horrible and all that stuff. I hope things turn out well at the birth, and, you know, the UK has something genuine to celebrate. So,
yeah, maybe my curmudgeon attitude towards this is because I've already seen this once with the previous generation, but that just means I'm old. Jim, thanks for pounding some optimism into this three martini lunch today. It was sorely needed.
There you go, Greg.
Jim Carity of National Review, thanks for being with us today. Best wishes to the royal family. I'm Greg Corumbus. We'll see you next time on the Three Martini Lunch.